So the very first story, in the very first chapter, in the very first book, in the entire New Testament is about a teenager who's stuck in a pretty messy situation. Worse than gum on a warm sidewalk, you know, it just gets all over. Every pull, the dressier it gets. It's night, so it's dark all around, and this mess that this guy finds himself in makes it even darker for him. The text tells us this guy's name is Joseph, and it tells us that he's a righteous man. We know from another source he's a carpenter, like you and me. This guy knew God, like you and me. He spent plenty of Sabbaths sitting with his family in a room like this, praying to God, singing, listening, hearing sacred texts, like you and me. This guy knows what it's like to be stuck. You know what it's like to be stuck in a messy situation? Trying to forget the last messy situation you found yourself stuck in? So this is where Joseph is, this teenage kid. Can you remember your last messy situation? Put yourself there just for a minute. Okay, here's the ingredients of the mess that Joe found himself in that night. His fiance is pregnant, and he had nothing to do with it. She says, God did it. And for that kind of thing, in that kind of place, she could get herself killed by the morality police. A private but very discreet divorce would be very painful, but very possible. And these are just the facts. Doesn't count the swirl of churning emotion that must have been going through every part of this guy's life. Just the facts. He's in a conflict of feelings. How about there? You've been there before? Conflict of feelings. Cheryl was there Thursday. Do I go up there? It's just surgery. Do I stay here? Then when she got up there, well, she came out of the surgery. Well, should I go back home? It's Advent. The church. Well, maybe I should stay. You find yourself in that situation. There's a right way, both ways, right? This is where he is. Put yourself right there, stuck in his shoes. Teenage kid. Mess. You want a believer, but you can't. What? You want a punisher, but you also want a protector. You're embarrassed and you're furious. You're sad, but you're scared. You want to run away, but you also want to help. And you know, whatever you choose to do, nobody's going to look good. Nobody's going to feel good. And this, y'all, is the very first story in the entire New Testament. This is how the story begins, right? This is the opening scene. And if this opening scene tells us what this whole story is going to be, how it follows, if it sets up a problem or a theme for the whole message that follows, and I think it does. There's a hint right here that the problem is going to involve more than just the bad people. It's going to involve the good people. Because remember, they just said he's a righteous guy, right? Right here at the first, it's one of them that we see. One of us. A church person. Maybe this suggests that good people especially need what God is up to and about here. Joseph's a pretty good man, and yet he's in this mess. Maybe it suggests that this is the kind of world and this is the kind of circumstance that Christ has come to. Real messy life. Not black and white, leave it to Beaver, TV kind of life where right and wrong are cleanly divided, neatly separated out, but a messy world. Not a clean world where problems can be neatly resolved, but a world full of goodness and contradiction, and even the goodness can be ambiguous, sticky. Contradiction stuck like that gum, stretched out on every single thing you try to get it off of. And sometimes finding the right way feels a whole lot like groping through the dark, full of forces that are way beyond our control. Maybe this is what galls Joseph the most, that this kind of thing has happened to his life and completely bypassed his control. He's been ambushed. Ambushed by a pregnancy he didn't cause, by a story he cannot believe, by a reputation he didn't want, by a situation he cannot fix. He didn't cause it, and now he cannot control it. I'm going to guess a situation that wild, especially for a person like Joseph, would drive him right up a wall, maybe higher than that thing, you know? Because he's been called righteous, right? You remember this? And it seems to me the righteous as a group are pretty clear in their preference for how things should go, very orderly, with a list, and a check next to it, and numbers even, right? They prefer the orderly and the manageable. It seems to me that as a whole, the group prefer a pretty clean ship, the righteous. The righteous care about things, and they take care of things too. Maybe people who don't care so much can afford to live chaotically. Some people, it doesn't really matter that every room in their house and their life is a little messy, but the righteous, well, they tend to pick up the place, right? They have a place for everything, and everything is in its place, right? They tend to live by goals and objectives. I think it's tough to see Joseph the carpenter as a chaotic man. How about you, right? I mean, he's a carpenter, right? He lives by straight edges and by cleanly cut lines. And by tightly formed joints, measurements, plans, straight lines, clean corners. Don't you think this news from Mary just sets him to grinding his teeth? Which puts him in a position to learn something, which most of us are a long, long time in learning. And it's this. We may think we're in control of our world and of our life, but we are not in control of our world or of our life. Generally, when something difficult happens to us, along the way, we'll say something like, oh, man, I've lost control of my life. Human beings don't lose control of our lives. What we lose is the illusion that we might have had some control at one point, right? Anne Lamott writes about this old man who has this wisdom. He's a retired dentist. He's been a recovering alcoholic for 50 years. When he says, I figured out just a few years ago that my profound sense of control for my world and for my life was just one more dang addiction. And it was all totally an illusion. He said when he'd see little kids riding in those back seats of the car and their car seats, back when they had these plastic steering wheels on the back of those car seats, and they're driving along and they think they're turning the car, he thought always of himself, sitting in that back seat with the plastic wheel, tooling along, while the mystery, while God is sitting right in front of him with the hand on the real wheel, right in front of him. Now, to tell you the truth, this analogy this guy says is a little simple because I'm pretty darn sure I've had a turn or two sitting at the real driver's seat and found myself in some pretty bad messes because my hand was on the wheel. But on balance, I think I can agree with this guy. If you take the analogy a little further, I'm confident that there are also different forces out there bumping into us and colliding into our lives and otherwise impacting the direction of our lives. We don't always have control, even when we think we've got our hands on those wheels. But the older I get, the more I think I'm that little kid in the back seat with that plastic wheel in my hand, and boy, do I get a tight grip. How about you? Do you find yourself with a tight grip? The HEB out where we live have these carts that you can put your kids in, which our kids are too big for now. But have you seen these at yours? They have these wheels. And boy, those kids go to town hanging on to those things. And it's hard to try to keep up. Sometimes when our kids would go after those, I'd try to turn it every time they turn it. Aren't you glad you don't have control of the wheel of your own life if this metaphor can keep moving? The older I get, the more it seems to me I'm the kid in the back seat, with my hand on that plastic wheel while the mystery is sitting right in front of me in the real driver's seat. Joseph doesn't yet know this about his life, and so having suffered the initial insult of losing the illusion of control, he regroups and tries to control that. Having lost its spouse control, having lost it God control, damage control. This is where he heads for next. He's going to come as close as he can to taking care of this, cleaning all this up. Remember, he's a carpenter, right? He's used to repairing damaged furniture, sanding down and buffing out and maybe lacquering over and repairing a loose joint to look as good as new, or at least as close to new as he can get it, because he's a carpenter, which is what is his life, reshaping things. So he's doing some management. He's going to try to manage Mary's problem and manage his problem. And of course, you know, when we manage things, it's going to involve secrets, right? The management of secrets. The controlled response to life will always involve the guarding of secrets, and it will always involve the managing of other people, which he chooses to do now. He chooses to manage her to a very different place, away from him, far away from him. The text says he planned to put her quietly away. And his motives couldn't be better. He really is doing this for her good. He really is denying his own need for vengeance, if he has any in him at all, which I'm not sure he does. He really is trying to keep her from shame, and maybe he's trying to keep her from harm too. The text says that Joseph does what he does because he's a decent person, because he is just. And you know what? He's wrong. Completely wrong. He's wrong because he is pushing down into the dark what belongs in the light. And because he's managing a woman as if she's a problem instead of a partner. And he's opting for the closed system of control instead of the openness to trust the mystery about him. So the mystery comes calling one night. When he's got his plan together, gets it all together, stretches, yawns, puts his head down on the pillow, falls asleep. You know when we're asleep. Not in control anymore, right? So there's this dream, and in the dream, Joseph sees an angel of the Lord who comes up to him. Joseph, Joseph, don't be afraid to take her for your wife. The child in her was conceived of the Holy Spirit. You shall call him Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. Now, did you catch the very first thing that angel said to him after calling his name? What did you hear him say? What did you hear the angel say? Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Rings pretty true, doesn't it? Don't be afraid. At the root, at the deepest root of all our controlling behavior, at the root is fear and anxiety. Now, some of us learn to look confident, but it's only because we've transferred our anxiety into the strength of our grip. It's all in the grip now. We're going to get it. Hang on. We're going right through this. We're frightened. And when we're frightened, we tighten our grip. And our stomach gets a knot in it. And our thinking narrows. And our eyes blur. And our vision is inconsistent. With controlling like that, what happens is we make ourselves unfree for any real intimacy, completely unavailable for any real truth, and we place ourselves at great distance from God. Because what we've done, of course, is put ourselves in the place of God, right? It's dangerous. So God speaks to this anxious, controlling, righteous man. Joseph, don't be afraid. Take her as your wife. Uncurl your fingers from your illusion of control. You can't keep standing back and passing judgments and calling out directions. You have to open yourself. You have to dive on in, son. You can't manage the mystery. You have to ride with it and let it take you. This is what it means to trust God. And no one here will tell you that it's easy. It's not easy. Real trust can be pretty hard because there's so little to go on, right? The word trust and belief in most places in our text can be equitably traded. Trust and belief. Real trust, real belief can be pretty hard because there's so little to go on. Look what Joseph has to go on. A few words that a character gave him showed up in his dream. It's not much. He may also have some stirrings kind of in his gut, in his pit, something in him that recognizes the truth that he's been waiting for a long time. He may also start to wonder if a person like Mary and the words that she says and the faith that she has maybe could be trusted, but all he's got really is a voice and maybe some stirrings. It's just not very much. So Joseph sits up in the middle of the night in his bed and it's dark and he can't see. He can't see the future. He can't see tomorrow. He can't even see himself where he is. But maybe, y'all, maybe that's right where faith begins to dawn on us. Like the light on a horizon in the morning slowly warms and colors the place, warms and colors life. It occurs to us that we don't have very much. Maybe we don't need very much more. There's a story that has gone around about some work that has been done in India with some kids who are profoundly autistic. These kids are so locked up inside their lives that they couldn't stand up. They couldn't move. You could try to hold them next to you, but they just, You couldn't do it. Dead weight. So they tried some things, a ton of different things. What do we do with these children? One guy notices something that when they push them around in the wheelchair, they take a hold of the armrest on the wheelchair. Something to this. So they tie a rope to a doorknob on one side of the room and then to the other doorknob on the other side of the room, and they put the kid's hand on the rope, sitting in the wheelchair, and they help the kid up, and he stands up. And not only stands up, but starts moving himself down the rope. Try it with other kids who are in this condition. The same thing happens. They'll move themselves along the rope if they have something to hang on to. Over time, they made the rope smaller and smaller and smaller until it was almost invisible, maybe something like fishing line. And they didn't just do dead ends. They started making paths through the place so the kids could move around. And if their hand was on that string, they could get anywhere they wanted to go. And then someone had a really fantastic idea. They clipped that string and put small pieces of almost invisible twine in their hands. And you know what? Those kids would walk. This is a pretty fair picture of trust. It's a pretty fair picture of belief, I think. We think we need to lean on and to cling to so much, and maybe at first, we did need to lean on something and see something about us. But that changes, doesn't it? We grow up. We find ourselves in a situation we can't control. What we think we're controlling dissolves like the fog in the morning. Maturity of faith is measured by how we learn to be less desperate, depend less on what we see, to lean on less, to loosen our grip, to lighten our need for control until at last we are walking in freedom of trust. But it ain't easy. And it doesn't come like that. Like those kids, you have to work your way down until you find your hands. Faith. So Joseph wakes up in the morning with nothing in his hands but a name for a little boy, Jesus. God saves. God with us, Emmanuel. And you know, the world has not been the same ever since. Just a name. God saves. Love commits. Love moves. You know, I found this to be true every single time. That I am not in it alone. As soon as I take that step, I discover that I have to take the step. As soon as I take that step, I find I am not in it alone, and neither are you. Will you pray with me? Living God, for all the ways you are telling us that we are not alone, especially for this kid who's about to be born again in our lives, we say thank you. And in our hands, put just enough to reach toward your hand in everyone we meet. In your Son's strong name and in your love, dear God, help us live. Amen.